9:05 p.m. Hearing room C, Chip Shannon presiding.
Okay, so I'll come to order, and we will have first one. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1121. And
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 1121.
Yes.
Abolishes the Department of Transportation, the Oregon Transportation Commission, creates Highway Department, Highway Commission, Oregon Department of Aviation, State Aviation Board, transfers driver motor vehicle services and transportation safety functions to Department of Revenue, transfers the motor carrier and public transit functions to the Department of Consumer Business Services, and transfers railroad functions to Public Utility Commission.
And more importantly, it has a relating clause relating to transportation. So later we could get and stuff that with just about anything we wanted. However, I just remembered that there might be some people here to testify on that bill. Has anybody signed up? Okay, go ahead. Come up. Pardon. Okay.
Madam Chair and the rest of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Mann. I won't take much of your time on this one. This will seem like deja vu to you, Madam Chair. 1121 has in it Senate Bill 108. You recall I was in front of your committee when we created a bill that created the Oregon Department of Aviation. I have an amendment that we discussed during Senate Bill 108. It was in conceptual form then, and you asked that I do that in 108 in the House. This, because Senate Bill 1121 has the same language as 108, I'm offering that amendment here on this bill. Does two things. It says that this new Department of Aviation has to abide by ORS 836-623 dealing with water impoundments, and you'll recall that issue with Lone Star Northwest, where we're a sand and gravel company. We dig holes. Sometimes there's water in these holes. Creates lakes. Last session, there was a bill that fixed all that problem. We just want to make sure that that stays the way it is. The amendment does a second thing, which is when the Department of Aviation, this new department, defines a hazard, we'd like them to do so using fact-finding and substantial evidence, which is the same language that is in 836-623. It makes it consistent with the statutes. I have testimony here for the rest of your members, as well as the amendment which I gave to your staff and for you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
When we work at it, this was just a hearing, then we have your amendments. Director Grace Cardigan, did you want to come and testify on 1121? It's just kind of a tap, Director Kernighan. Do you understand? I said it before you got here. It's just a tap to get it in.
Chairman Shannon, members of the committee,
yeah,
Grace Kernighan, Director of ODOT. I have a letter I'll submit for you in opposition to this bill. We think that it's not a well-conceived idea, and we have a lot of comments on it, so if you'd like to hear those at another time, we'd be happy to give them to you at another time.
Okay, thank you. Right. Okay, thanks. I didn't mean for you to have to come for this. Okay, if there's no other testimony, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1121. Okay, and what's the other one? Okay. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 498. Is that the request of Senator Fisher's bill?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 498 requires suspension of driving privileges and registration of vehicles for persons who is convicted of abandoning vehicles. It stipulates that the suspension remains in effect until a person pays the cost of removal, storage, and disposition of the abandoned vehicles.
Okay. Has anyone signed up?
No.
So we will close a public hearing. Just a minute. People are about to leave. Yeah. Oh, well. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 498. Okay. And then was there another one?
Yes. 15-5, I have checked. 1301, that's not here.
Can I grab that sheet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She's going to get the sheet.
Hi. This is so tricky. We've already worked two bills.
Huh?
We've already tapped in and out two bills.
Have you had members in law school?
Nope. But Susan is chairing another meeting because the chair had to leave. So.
Oh, I'm only asking, how did you tap in the bill?
They said you don't have to.
Quorum.
They said you don't have to on here.
Yeah,
on a hearing. Nope, just on a work session. So if they told me.
That's the figure?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Can I just back up to my office?
No! No! You're here now! So she captured somebody for me.
Okay.
Somebody's here. Well, I don't think we have anybody here for it.
I bet.
Who's Ross Williams? Is Ross Williams here? Are you supporting 1301?
No.
Well, okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1301. But there's not anybody here to speak for the bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1301. Okay. What's next? Okay, are they here? Okay. Then we're going to open a public hearing on
Is 1301 likely to get rescheduled?
Yes.
Can I draft amendments?
Yes.
To include the Astoria bypass and the Newburgh-Dundee bypass?
With pleasure. Right. Let's go. Let's see. Put some teeth in it somehow. Try to turn it. Okay, which one is that? This one? Okay. Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 855. Does anyone testify?
Okay.
And we're going to close. You want to say what it does?
Senate Bill 855, Madam Chair and members of the committee, requires the Department of Transportation to post signs at highway construction and repair projects showing annual amounts of money paid to private contractors for the work on highway construction and repair projects. And if you ever see the floor again, it will be a different form.
They have a nice relating font.
Okay.
So we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill.
Well, remember, we can do covered bridges.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, he's in the hall.
Okay, let's bring him. Oh, there. Here's Senator George. There's another pass.
Need to go to Okay.
Yes. Okay, we are. Okay, let's go. Before? Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 907. And the other sheet. Do you want to tell us about the bill?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 907 requires that retail installment contracts for sale of motor vehicles include the amount paid by the seller if any to discharge security interest, lien, or lease interest in trade in motor vehicles. Specifies that the interest rate limit does not apply the amount of prior loan or lease related to trade in motor vehicles included in motor vehicles. And I trust the witnesses will clarify all that.
Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Darrell Foy. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. OADA represents approximately 250 new car franchises in the state of Oregon. Under current practices, dealers do negative equity loans when they finance a vehicle. What a negative equity is you bring a car in to trade it in and you owe $5,000 on the loan on your car, your car is only worth $4,000. So now you have $1,000 of negative equity on the vehicle that you're trading in. And we take that $1,000 of negative equity and we add it to the new vehicle you're purchasing, and we give you a single loan that covers the entire cost of the vehicle and the negative equity. And that's current practices. There was a October 1, 1998 revised Federal Reserve Board staff commentary to Regulation Z. Made some of the national lenders a little nervous about the possibility of having to give two loans to consumers, one for the negative equity and one for the new vehicle purchase. And the way to solve that problem is to make it clear in Oregon statute that what dealers have been doing all along is something they can continue to do, which is combine the negative equity with the current vehicle purchase and roll it all into a single loan. And the statutory language does that. The Department of Justice has been working with Ford Motor Credit, who developed the bill, and we introduced it at their request. And the joint request between the Department of Justice and Ford Motor Credit is that we delete Section 2 of the current bill, so it would be just the language in Section 1 of the bill that would be added to statute. I've talked to the committee staff prior, and if the committee so desires, of course, they could do it by conceptual amendment, because it's pretty easy. I could come back with an LC draft amendment next week at the committee's request. But this would not change current practices and how auto dealers are financing loans. It would simply address a portion of the statute that is not clear, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions? If not, Mr. Gene Ebersole.
Yes, Madam Vice Chair. My name is Eugene Ebersole. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the Financial Fraud Section of the Department of Justice. We've been working directly with General Counsel for Ford Motor Credit, who gave this to OADA to introduce. We have no problem whatsoever, and we're in concurrence with the concept of the bill. We found a significant problem with the second part of the bill, the inclusion of a lease for a motor vehicle. That's subsection 9 that's being added on as part 2. And that's because there is an internal conflict, perhaps, between Regulation Z, which is truth in lending, and Regulation M, which is truth in leasing. And rather than get into trying to correct that and come up with some language at this time, Ford Motor Credit felt more comfortable with just eliminating that whole section, and next session maybe we'll try and come up with an Oregon version of the Vehicle Leasing Act that's specific to Oregon, that the industry feels comfortable with and that the department can work together with them on in the interim. By leaving that part two, it just doesn't sit in. It's putting apples and oranges together. Because the bill basically, the enabling clause talks about retail sales and lease and loans, and leases are a different animal than loans, and shoving that something in about leasing that just doesn't apply and potentially truly comes in conflict with Regulation Z could cause all kinds of constitutional problems for the court system and department and the industry that we don't want to make it more confusing than it already is. We agree that the negative equity financing and the retail installments is the way the practice has been, and by eliminating the second part and leaving the first, we will give the industry a clean bill of health to go forward without any fears of litigation or complications in the courts over that issue. And we are agreement too that I think it's a simple enough a matter for this committee, if it so desires, to just strike out that last section by interlineation and letting the bill go forward as it stands. There was no other problem with it.
And you're from the?
I'm from the Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud Section, Consumer Protection.
DG.
Attorney General.
Okay. And you have no problem with that, Darrell?
Madam Chair, we rarely agree with the Department of Justice, but in this case we do.
Okay. And what number was that?
907.
Okay.
Madam Chair, while we have them there.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Senator. So would be doing page 3, we'd be striking line 5 through 9, and then we would remove from line 11, lease, the mention of lease there too, or would we strike out completely sections?
Strike out the section that deals with ORS Chapter 82 in its entirety. So we're going to be working. The first part deals with ORS Chapter 83, and the lease section deals with ORS Chapter 82. So you'd strike end ORS 82.
Okay.
.025.
But you wouldn't be removing the section 9, item number 9 of section 2?
Yes, you would remove all of section item 9.
All of that. Then
whatever relates, whatever in there relates to that entire chapter ORS.
Okay. Plus the word lease entered into?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Okay, if you would you give us a copy of the hand engrossed that we can take to legislative council?
I think Mr. Fuller is
I'm sure be happy to do that.
And we will have an amendment made drawn up and bring it back. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
There's no further witnesses, so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 907. Okay. And you're out of here by 3:30. Whatever you want. Yeah. Oh, good. That's good. Okay.
I wasn't talking about me, Madam Chair.
No, not you. Okay.
KW was just sitting in the yard. I was waiting for me to get home.
Right. Okay, now what? Is there another easy one? So people can be with him. Okay, where's the one? We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1065. And you want to tell us about the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1065 requires TriMet and the Department of Transportation to comply with certain conditions of approval for issuance for permits, licenses, or certificates related to the West Side Corridor Light Rail Project. It allows agencies that issue such permits, licenses, or certificates to continue to exercise the enforcement authority over the permits, licenses, and certificates after completion of the project. And it prohibits modifications of the final order relating to the West Side Light Rail Project.
Okay, Kim Ramos and Ken Zill, okay, from Providence Hospital, and Linda Adler from the City of Beaverton. Can you come up to the panel? Would you come up to the panel? Please. State your name for the record and tell us why we need this bill.
Hi, Chairman Shannon, members of the committee. My name is Tim Ramos. I'm a lawyer from Portland, and I'm here today on behalf of the Peter Cook family. This bill is intended to cure what appears to be an unintended consequence of the special land use power that was granted to ODOT and TriMet in the supersiding law for Westside Light Rail. The current law grants absolute power to these agencies to unilaterally repudiate promises made to local government during the light rail siting process. The bill would cut back on this authority after the rail line is up and operating, and its purpose has already been served. The Peter courts are vitally interested because they have been involved in light rail planning since its inception, and their support has been great. They actually, free of any charge, donated much of the land that the major rail station sits on today, also dedicated land that was critical to certain road improvements that were necessary, and actually expended many hundreds of thousands of dollars in engineering related to the project. So they share the concern of local government about this temptation to use the special power to cut back on promises that were made because they, of course, in their planning, relied on many of those same promises. The existing law, referred to often as Senate Bill 573, it's not been codified, was adopted for a very good purpose. The transportation agencies appeared before the legislature and said, we need, in order to obtain federal funding, to be able to provide certainty to the federal government that we won't be mired endlessly in litigation. And they said that Oregon's system created the possibility that they could be attacked in that way and that federal funding might not be available because of those uncertainties. The law was then designed to give them special power to exempt themselves from Oregon's usual land use process in order to serve as a shield from that possibility of litigation. And in addition to those powers, they were granted a very special power, which was the power to unilaterally, on their own, with no judicial review, change the requirements of the project in case it had to be tailored to the needs of obtaining funding. The law was, of course, successful. The project obtained the necessary funding. It has been built, but there is a problem. Once the money was obtained for the project, and once it was up and operating, it was, of course, no longer necessary to have this special power as a shield from litigation. But the law stayed on the books, and that power can now be used as a threat, as a sword, against local governments who might insist upon the keeping of certain promises that were made during the land use process. The power creates, I think, a very great temptation on the part of members of the ODOT bureaucracy who have moved on to other projects to threaten the use of this power against local governments who have the temerity to remind the agency of certain promises that remain unkept. The language of the bill that's before you basically says that after the project is done, the special power to change the rules and to eliminate commitments goes away. In other words, once you have enjoyed the fruits of the promises made, you can no longer renege on those promises. The Peter courts today offer an amendment, the Dash 1 amendment, and essentially this would say that instead of an absolute prohibition on cutting back on promises, the question it would be whether or not the proposed modification was concurred in by the local government involved. In other words, if there was consensus with the local government, the property owners would have to go along with the agreement. Instead of a unilateral elimination of promises, it would require concurrence by the local government. Now, we have chosen to suggest that particular approach in the hopes that the bill would then be supported by ODOT and TriNet, because this particular approach has precedent, this concurrence of the local government approach. The agencies actually previously signed an agreement to take that approach in order to try to resolve a dispute in Washington County. In my testimony on the fourth page, there is an Exhibit A. And you will see that that is an agreement signed on behalf of TriMet and ODOT. And in the third paragraph, you will see that they agree to enter into an agreement with Washington County to not amend the critical land use document, which is called the LUFO, without the concurrence of Washington County. And it's our hope, because they've agreed to do this previously, that they will not view our amendment as possible. The particular dispute that was involved at the time that this agreement was entered into involved the removal of a ramp onto the freeway. This particular agreement was brokered by Greg Walden during the 1996 session of the legislature, which dealt with some critical transportation issues.
Probably 1995.
I'm sorry. Yes, 1995.
Mm-hmm.
There's a special session. It was a special session that dealt with transportation issues. The current status of the dispute is that the ODOT has argued that this ramp needed to be removed, even though it had promised to replace the ramp. The ramp was actually removed because of the necessity of removing it to build light rail. They were able to obtain the agreement of Washington County and certain property owners to participate in certain road improvements that were necessary to accommodate the loss of the ramp in return for the promise that they would put it right back. They changed their mind later and had opposed Washington County's efforts to get the ramp to be returned. At the time that this agreement was entered into, they were threatening to litigate the requirement of returning the ramp, and they were threatening to use their special Senate Bill 573 power to eliminate the ramp requirement. And as you can see, they agreed to do two things. One was not to litigate, and second was not to exercise that power without the concurrence of Washington County. Now, to date, The agencies have not concluded an agreement with Washington County. We're now 3.5 years later. And it's our hope that they will recognize that they've made that commitment and that it ought to be kept, and therefore it makes sense to put it into the statute. That is our hope. The current status is that ODOT has filed a case at LUBA. It's currently pending, raising the opportunity to challenge the ramp once again. And they have also communicated to me the possibility that they would use their special power under the statute to remove their promise from the past. The last exhibit in my package is a letter from the Department of Justice representing ODOT. The lawsuit, or the LUBA case that they recently filed, we've been working very hard to settle by convincing Washington County to back off on some of its requirements. We concluded an agreement, but as you can see in this letter, the moment this bill appeared, they decided they would no longer be interested in reaching settlement. The possibility that the special power to eliminate the ramp promise might be taken away has ended the negotiation. That's the background. It's our hope you'll recognize the importance of making sure that this power cannot be abused. Thank you.
I just was looking at your letter, January 31, 1996. No amendment. That was loose. Okay. Next.
Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Kenneth Vinsley. I'm a facilities representative for the Providence Health System, and today I'm representing St. Vincent's Hospital. I'd like to just bring forth some of the background that we went through in getting this light rail station sited, etc. We spent many hours working with TriNet, establishing a light rail station that could work for the community. We took into account major issues of safety with regard to the access of ambulances to the hospital, the access from the fire station to various housing areas, and then we spent a lot of money on pedestrian access and bicycle accommodations in order to get people to this light rail station. The understanding was this ramp would be put back in. Without the ramp, we've in essence created a pseudo freeway of Barnes Road. We now take the freeway traffic down past the light rail station to the next on-ramp to get it back on. As the development of the Peter Court property comes and the tie-in of the properties north of the intersection, we're going to see a large quantity of people coming to the light rail station. The safety of these people crossing a freeway doesn't make any sense. If indeed the intent was to have that as a pseudo freeway, we located the light rail station in the wrong place. So the support from the community was based on putting the light rail station in one location, establishing the on-ramp, so that we had safe access to the light rail station. My concern is, unless we have a process that allows public input to mean something, then the whole public input process is a farce. We go through years of study, input, create a system that's safe for individuals to get to the hospital, etc., and then we allow Metro and ODOT to arbitrarily say, well, we've changed our mind. My concern is that deteriorates the whole relationship between the community and TriNet, or community and ODOT. And I can tell you I've been working with TriNet on various issues for 25 years. And what this is really saying is there's no point in doing that. Don't bother with your input, because no one's going to pay any attention to it. So I seriously support this, because I think if we don't do this, we're going to lead to some serious safety issues. That is an extremely hazardous road already. We have had one employee killed at the intersection right on the interchange. We've had another one thrown 60 feet by a person coming through the light. That is an extremely hazardous stretch of road. And now to say that we're going to leave the freeway traffic on Barnes Road and let the pedestrians hazard their way across that to the light rail station is unconscionable. That's all I have to say.
I'm Linda Adlarge. I'm
George.
Property comes, and the tie-in of the properties north of the intersection, we're going to see a large quantity of people coming to the light rail station. The safety of these people crossing a freeway doesn't make any sense. If indeed the intent was to have that as a pseudo-freeway, we located the light rail station in the wrong place. So the support from the community was based on putting the light rail station in one location, establishing the on-ramp so that we had safe access to the light rail station. My concern is, unless we have a process that allows public input to mean something, then the whole public input process is a farce. We go through years of study, input, create a system that's safe for individuals to get to the hospital, etc., and then we allow Metro and ODOT to arbitrarily say, well, we've changed our mind. My concern is that deteriorates the whole relationship between the community and TriNet, or community and ODOT. And I can tell you I've been working with TriNet on various issues for 25 years. And what this is really saying is there's no point in doing that. Don't bother with your input, because no one's going to pay any attention to it. So I seriously support this, because I think if we don't do this, we're going to lead to some serious safety issues. That is an extremely hazardous road already. We have had one employee killed at the intersection right on the interchange. We've had another one thrown 60 feet by a person coming through the light. That is an extremely hazardous stretch of road. And now to say that we're going to leave the freeway traffic on Barnes Road and let the pedestrians hazard their way across that to the light rail station is unconscionable. That's all I have to say.
I'm Linda Adlard.
I'm George. I have a question.
Oh, I'm just asking it quickly. With what justification would they deny the reestablishment of that ramp? Have you had an explanation that makes sense to you?
Well, there have been many. None that makes sense to me. Many have to do with money. Others have to do with engineers' view that the removal of the ramp and the placement of those trips that would otherwise be on the freeway onto the local system makes the freeway work better. And so that's a benefit. So there are a number of arguments
for the freeway.
For the freeway.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The next witness is Linda Adlard.
Thank you. I'm Linda Adlard. I'm Chief of Staff at the City of Beaverton. And I'm here today to support this legislation. This property is currently in the City of Beaverton. Prior, when this originally began, it was Washington County. We have since annexed the land. We have a wonderful working relationship with ODOT and with TriNet. We've got our light rail through our city, and so we've worked with them for many, many years and have done that very successfully and have always been able to take what their word was and ours and work things out well. This has brought up a bit of a concern, certainly, for our citizens in that they've paid for a light rail system. They have compromised their ability to move around through not having a ramp, dumping all of this traffic into our local streets into our quality neighborhoods where people live. All of us are willing to put up with some of that and try to have the good things such as a light rail system in the end. One of the largest issues for us is the lack of adequate fire and emergency vehicle access. Now, the ramp is open to emergency vehicles, but it is not adequate. Our fire district understood when they agreed to close the ramp that we would someday have the opportunity to respond a little bit faster and a little bit better. And so that was very important to us. We have conditions of approval in land use orders for the very reason that this was brought up. We condition different opportunities to participate in transportation or whatever it happens to be so that all of the things that citizens need, the public hearings we go through and make commitments as a government to citizens about how we will have a finished product and what that finished product is going to look like, is very important. We can't go back to our citizens very well and say, well, we had public hearings and we heard these things, and our city council, your elected officers in Beaverton have agreed that they would close this ramp, but someday it will be open. And so there won't be traffic in your neighborhood forever, and your children will be able to be safe again crossing the streets, and our elderly parents don't have to be as concerned. So we find that without having this, it certainly gives government a bit of a bad reputation about how we've treated our citizens and how we have promised things which have not happened. So the trust issue, I think, is there for us. Certainly the importance of that ramp and the traffic issues are very, very important to us. All of our city council, we've had many discussions about this, and each of them has supported the insistence that we have this ramp back in. We work many, many decisions surrounding other land use issues and transportation, and when one doesn't fall in place, all of these other decisions we've made about how traffic will operate, and of course, you know, Washington County and Beaverton have some of the worst traffic, quite frankly, of anywhere. So it's very important for us. We're in full support of that. We understand that money's always tight and that those are issues for ODOT and for TriMet, but we've put the money in, our citizens voted, and they've paid out of their pockets for the light rail, and now they want to have the safety of having emergency access quickly.
Okay, thank you. I think, because we want to get through our bills, the deadline, I will have Marty Seaver. So, do you live in Salem? Okay, then we'll have you come and testify, and then I'll have the ODOT and TriMet respond another day.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Marty Sevier, and I'm here representing the Peter Court family also. I'm their project manager and development coordinator for their property. I'm here in support of the bill with the family. It's a good bill because it eliminates ODOT's absolute power to cancel promises it made to local governments and property owners when it was seeking approval for light rail. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand what has happened here between a hardworking, turn-of-the-century Washington County farm family, the Peter Court family, and ODOT's Department of Transportation. In a nutshell, ODOT said, if you will help me save money during the construction of the Sunset Transit Center, I will build you a roadway system that you can count on to support it. Now ODOT is saying it's had its fingers crossed behind its back during the deal, and the Peter Courts are now out over $50,000 in legal fees and other fees trying to make them keep their promise. All of you can imagine the complexities of trying to protect undeveloped family farmland within the metropolitan urban growth boundaries. You can also imagine how difficult and expensive it is to come up with a plan that will allow you to keep your property and develop it in a way that is community-oriented and economically feasible. You can also imagine what it would be like if your land was the first land to be chosen for planning efforts for the first go-around of a transit-oriented development ordinance to meet Metro's 2040 growth program in Washington County. Well, that's exactly the case here. Since the Westside Light Rail bond issue passed back in 1992, planning began in a big way for all of the Westside Light Rail stations. The Peter Courts were made aware of all the transportation plans that were being implemented to support the light rail project so they could incorporate those plans into the future development of their property. They donated 3 acres to the light rail project. They dedicated the right-of-way for New Barnes Road to be used as a temporary shoe fly for Highway 217 traffic around the construction activities at the light rail station. They invested $300,000 of their own money in engineering and design of the New Barnes Road. They felt this would help them begin the development of their farmland into the urban environment envisioned by Metro. You could also say they began with an investment based on ODOT promises in the Peter Court Town Square, which is a 170,000-square-foot shopping center located at New Barnes Road and Cedar Hills Boulevard. All of the design and planning for the shopping center had to take into account the best guess of their engineers and planners for the future development of traffic. The Barnes Road on-ramp was an integral part of that transportation planning and investment decision process. Without the ramp, future traffic will become too congested on Barnes Road. It will have detrimental effects on the in-and-out traffic of the shopping center and all of the future intersections planned along New Barnes Road. In October of 1997, Washington County adopted a new transit-oriented development ordinance for all of the Peter Court property that further increased the development densities. The entire master plan for the ordinance is based upon the reconstruction of the Barnes Road on-ramp. It seems to me, and it ought to seem to you, that if ODOT wants out of its obligations, it should have the concurrence of Washington County's Board of Commissioners and not just, oh, I had my fingers crossed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And we will work this bill later next week, promise. Thank you. We'll let you know. Thank you very much. I want to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1065. The representative Lewis out there.
I'm sorry.
I know. Yes, it's a bad. Thanks. Thank you. Yes. She's not there. Well, okay, what's the next one? Well, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1213. In case she doesn't come back, what do you want to say?
Senate Bill 1213, I'm sure members of the committee, requires the governor to commit a zero-based budget for the Department of Transportation.
Do you want to say something, Mr. Marsh? Okay.
Madam Chair, if you would like to have a response to the point, I'd be happy to.
So you want to just briefly?
Okay.
You're not responding to anything. I mean, Mrs. Lewis. I mean, Representative Lewis.
Madam Chair, what I'll do is just Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation. I just wanted to indicate to Senator and to members that we'd be happy to work on different structures for budgets. I have significant concerns about putting into the statute a zero-based budgeting approach for one agency. I have a lot of information as a professor on the side on the subject of budgeting that I could read for you from textbooks on the subject of ways to budget that I think could help on getting to what the members want. But I really think what was selected with the legislature last session on program budgeting is a better approach to meet the needs of the legislature. So I won't read in the records information now, but I'll work with the chair and others on style and getting the information in that we need to.
Mr. Marsh, I know that the new co-chairs of Representative Lewis, she asked you to do part of the ODOT budget this time in a zero-based budget manner, and you complied, didn't you? Isn't that my understanding?
Madam Chair, correct. We did a review and a zero-based approach. The issue is, if you put it in the statute, that it's supposed to be part of the automated budget, and at the detail level, it's going to be a significant requirement, which I don't think the return on investment is there. We're certainly willing to summarize information for the committee like we did here, but to do the entire budget that way, I think, would be something where you don't get the return on this money spent.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill. Which one was that? 1213. Well, you just missed two bills.
I know that
I'm a good. Okay.
What was that one? Okay. Let's hear from Senate Bill, okay, well, the 1058. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1058. And Sarah Fuller here, is she the one that wanted that? Whose bill is that? Do you want to tell us about the bill? Okay. Oh.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, 1058 exempts motor vehicles that are less than 8 years old from requirements of certification, certification of compliance and pollution control equipment standards.
Can these two vote against that? Okay, first, is Kelly Taylor here? I want to hear from you first, please. From DMV. Is this part of your agency?
Madam Chair, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. It would affect our agency somewhat. I've heard Senator George talk about a little bit. This is the one exempting 8-year or newer cars from the EQ.
Mm-hmm.
We are the ones, currently DEQ is tied to the renewal cycle mm-hmm. of vehicle registration. So if you live in the DEQ area, when you get your renewal notice from DMV, it includes information that you're supposed to go to DEQ and take the car past the emissions testing. And when you get that little compliance form, that's what you submit with your vehicle renewal notice with us so we know you've done that, and then we issue the renewal stickers for your vehicle. And what this bill would do is say any car that's 8 years or newer would not be required to do that. And once a car became over 8 years old, the next renewal, it would be required to do that. It's a little bit of programming change for us to change the renewal reminder system just based on the age of the car, comparing the age of the car, the year of the car, to today's year. And on newer cars, the renewal notice wouldn't mention DEQ. On cars that are 8 years or older, it would. So that's how we would implement it.
Does anybody have a question, Kelly? Aren't the newer cars all in compliance anyways?
We don't have anything here from DEQ.
We have to
that would be DEQ, Madam Senator.
Okay, then, why don't you sit close, Mr. Taylor? Well, I'm going to pull three men up here that aren't very excited about this yet. Ralph Broner and Greg... Chris is a female. And Greg Green and Chris... Tiger Bomber. Did we lose Chris? Okay. That's all right. Come on. So we lost Ralph, too. Okay. It's your agency, anyway. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Ralph, you're up here, and you're out there playing. Yes, I almost said Commissioner Groner, but lobbyist Groner. Okay. Okay. Go ahead, Greg.
Okay.
He's right. Okay. Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Greg Green. I'm the Employee Administrator for DEQ. What I would like to do is just take about 30 seconds to give you the history of the air quality program in the state of Oregon and kind of tell you how this bill would affect that air quality program, especially in the Portland region. At one time, for the pollutant ozone, the Portland region violated the national standard once out of every 3 days. And what happens is when that happens, the EPA comes down and they put a form of designation on the region that they call a non-attainment designation. And what this non-attainment designation does, it puts some pretty severe requirements on industry so that any new industry that tries to come into the area or any existing industry that exists there, before they can do any modification processes or start any new processes, they have to install some very costly pollution control equipment. If the area still fails to meet air quality standards, what they can do is they can come down and they can impound your highway, federal highway fund. So it is economically necessary to remove that non-attainment designation. The way this is done is you have to develop a contract that's called a maintenance plan with the EPA that lists a certain set of strategies that you'll implement over a 10-year time period to keep you in compliance with air quality standards, and the vehicle inspection program is one of those. As a matter of fact, it was chosen by two legislative committees chaired by Representative Tom Bryan in 1993 and 1995. What this bill would do is it would exempt over 220,000 cars from having to comply with that vehicle inspection program and cause additional pollution, almost 5 tons of additional pollution in the atmosphere every day, which would almost certainly throw the Portland region back out of compliance with air quality standards again.
Just a second. Now, right now, though, we're in good shape, aren't we? That's
right.
Right now, we have very good air quality. And you're saying the brand new cars that are coming out are not built to meet that, those standards?
What this, the brand new cars are, yes, Chair, Madam Chair, but what this bill would do is it would exempt cars up to 8 years old.
What if we change that to 4?
There is, to be honest with you, there is some draft guidance coming out from EPA that's still in draft form that suggests that cars 4 years old and younger may, in fact, not benefit from complying with the vehicle inspection.
Would you oppose this bill if we changed 8 to 4?
What I would do is I would probably say that there is some guidance coming out on it that's going to be final in the next month or two, which will probably show that that's,
it looks good.
That that's good.
That's a good idea. Okay, Mr. Grano, what is your
question? Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes.
Greg, isn't it true on page 2 where you refer that the program has reduced the VOC pollution by 26,000 pounds per day, but actually the result, that is really the thing that's provided that are the new technologies in automobiles?
Chair, Senator Choice, I'm sorry. Could you repeat that again, please?
Yeah. You claim on third paragraph on page 2 that the program has reduced the VOC pollution by 26,000 pounds per day in the Portland area. Isn't it true that the program hasn't been responsible for actually the new technologies and the engines of these brand new cars?
Madam Chair, Senator George, that's partially true. The cars are much cleaner than they were before. The problem is that even though the cars are cleaner, you have very many more cars on the road these days. In Portland region alone, what we're predicting between now and the year 2006 is that the vehicle miles traveled are going to increase by about 5 million miles per day. What the vehicle inspection program does is it forces people to keep their cars maintained according to manufacturer's standards so that that equipment can in fact function like it's supposed to do.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Yes.
Greg, actually, when we get to the low-sulfur fuel, the bill that Senator Wild, the two bills that Senator Wild and I have right now, about 50% of the ozone polluting materials will be gone just automatically by that. And with the brand-new cars that are coming 2003 to 2006, it'll take this number just down to numbers that are hard for us to imagine. Isn't that the case?
Madam Chair, Senator George, that's possible. We haven't completed technical work, but what our work shows so far is that low sulfur fuel would be equivalent to removing about 500,000 cars from the roadway in the Portland-Salem region alone.
Okay, so this may be a bill that's time to come. Because if there was a time period in there that said in a car that is from a certain year make, because most of the vehicles, particularly produced over the last 7 or 8 years, actually have computers making adjustments to that engine, even if as it wears. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator George, even if low sulfur fuel is implemented, which is by no means a certainty so far, that wouldn't take effect until you're sometime between 2004 and 2008, which puts it up to 10 years out, and it's hard to take credit for something that's going to take place between 6 and 10 years from now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't. Okay. Now, Mr. Groner, would you have a problem if we changed 8 to 4?
Madam Chair, my testimony will be very short. I want to do two bills, 1058 and 1150. May I have your permission to testify on both of those collectively?
Of course.
Same issue to me.
You have to stay here. What is this?
Yeah,
no kidding. It's beautiful outside. I thought you
have
to stay here, too.
I thought you were going with me.
But we're going to share it.
You forgot that.
We're going to hope. We hope to quit it. Fine. Leslie, we're going to do you as soon as you come. Okay. 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 Go ahead. Two bills.
Thank you.
1058 and 1305.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry, distinguished members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I represent AFSCME. And you probably wonder why I would care about this, but we do have the members that work at DEQ and all the agencies so far, other than ODOT that you've talked about today. But I'm kind of changing how I look at all this. I'm here to talk on 1058 and 1150, more from a common sense point of view. Let me say that where I live in the Portland metro area all my life, we've developed a 10-year plan and made a deal and a commitment to EPA that this is the plan. Part of that plan was the kind of vehicle testing we're now going into with the dynamometer that costs $55,000 per dynamometer. This is called enhanced testing because rather than drive in the way we used to and just sit in our car and they put this goose up the tail of our
I've
car.
I've never been there. So
well, they do. They put it up the tailpipe, and my tailpipe was sorry about that, and I would have been too. But now you get out of your car, and they put it on a dynamometer, which enhanced testing means that it's 100% improvement over the old system. And EPA said, okay, what else are you going to do? We're going to test cars that are under 2 years or older, and we're going to either use a basic test or the old put it up the tailpipe or the fancy name called the dynamometer where you get out of the car and it simulates your driving on the freeway. The only point I want to make is an essential part of the deal with EPA was the enhanced auto testing on the dynamometer. And an essential part was, over into the other bill, 1058, was we'll test these on cars 2 years or older, and that was agreed upon for a 10-year agreement or a deal. We're now only 2 or 3 years into it. So I thought about it, and I said, why the hell am I even testifying? Business ought to be the one.
You don't use that language.
I'm sorry. Why the heck? I apologize. Why the heck am I even testifying? When I thought it ought to be business that's up here today because it affects them more than it does me. Those who might think this affects my union, let me clarify. This is one issue that really, Greg would agree, doesn't really affect my members because in the first place, they're using temporaries too much. We defeated the bill last session on the House side to privatize my members. We won, and I was raised that if you win, you win, raise your hand and go on. But so far, we still don't have our permanent members. That's down in Ways and Means. We're still using temps, so I really don't win or lose in this situation anyway. So I'm more here really to talk about one issue. That is the agreement, the unhealthy air, that leads to cost to government over on the health, the Oregon health plan, and in our cost of health plans that we pay for, such as
I do. Mr. Boner, I do not mean to interrupt you, but technology moves on, and even the EPA said it's a great agreement, but we're thinking maybe you shouldn't be doing these just because with cars under 4 years old. And if EPA comes out with it and says, then would you say, we made an agreement?
If EPA agreed, I don't have a problem. I just don't want
okay.
you. I don't want somebody changing a deal with
okay.
EPA and having them come down
okay.
on
all right.
The impact, a couple things I want to say is my top priority. I lived there all my life, as you
yes.
did. You lived in a
part
great county
it.
One year,
mm-hmm.
part of your time. Then you moved to this county. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
The and this is a great county also. The impact on business, I've talked to business leaders, and I would only say this. If you have a deal with EPA and you renege on the deal, and you threaten the credits. So let's say you get 100 credits and you...
We are not going to go against EPA.
Okay.
Deal.
On either bill?
Well, we'll talk about the next one.
Oh, okay. But they're both... I'm combining both bills because they're both agreements with EPA.
Okay.
And both bills go against the agreement with EPA.
Okay.
So if one passed, you're going against EPA. And to me, that's my common sense way of thinking, that threatens... You're going to have to pick up that somewhere else, and the one place you're going to go is more stringent and costly industrial controls. Now, business needs to answer that, but the reason a union, a public employee union, cares about business, I want to say, compared to some other unions in this building, is I want business to do good, hire lots of employees so they're paying income tax, so I have a general fund down here that can fund my members' programs. And that's why I am not anti-business.
Maybe you can go down to your union people and tell them you killed 1150. Then you could go home with a victory.
Well, thank you. That's
okay.
nice. Because I was just at the bathroom, by the way, and they told me 1150 passed, and I lost my job, and I didn't know. Okay, so all I want to say is...
We'll finish with you.
I want to end up by saying thank you.
Okay.
I'm having a hard time being serious. But we must be very careful that we do something that would put us in non-attainment. We currently
right.
are in attainment,
we'll do that.
And
okay.
we don't want to do that. That's
yeah.
all I have
okay,
to say.
Thank you.
Thank you very
sure.
much.
Thanks. Go ahead. Nice to have you today. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Yankee, I'm sorry that I wasn't in the room when you called my name. I'm trying to...
Oh, that's okay. I know.
The committees and it's
hard. It's a busy day.
I believe that DEQ probably covered most of the points
mm-hmm.
that I was going to make, so I'm just going to quickly say
mm-hmm.
that Last summer, the Portland area exceeded the ozone standard 4 times, and the Medford area exceeded the standard 5 times. So we're really teetering on the brink of compliance with these federal standards. So anything that might put us out of attainment is a very serious issue.
Wait a minute, 5 days out of 365?
We'll have to ask.
Okay, that's great.
Actually, anytime you go past that, we're putting people's health into
serious. Whatever. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And the second point is that if the legislature wants to do something like this, they should wait until the EPA has made that determination. This is premature to pass mm-hmm. legislation such as this. We can wait until EPA has made the determination that it's not important to test newer cars.
Well, we should put in there based on EPA's next recommendation.
And then okay. And then lastly, basically, technological progress is happening, and we do have a national push to reduce the sulfur content of gasoline, and those could very well render the inspection and maintenance program unnecessary. But until that happens, we shouldn't tamper with the strategies that exist now.
Okay.
And that's all.
Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1058, and we'll take seriously into consideration.
And both bills go against the agreement with EPA.
Okay.
So if one passed, you're going against EPA. And to me, that's my common sense way of thinking, that threatens, you're going to have to pick up that somewhere else. And the one place you're going to go is more stringent and costly industrial controls. Now, business needs to answer that. But the reason a union, a public employee union, cares about business, I want to say, compared to some other unions in this building, is I want business to do good, hire lots of employees so they're paying income tax, so I have a general fund down here that can fund my members' programs. And that's why I am not anti-business.
Maybe you can go down to your union people and tell them you killed 1150. Then you could go home with a victory.
Well, thank you. That's
okay.
Nice. Because I was just at the bathroom, by the way, and they told me 1150 passed, and I lost my job, and I didn't know. Okay, so all I want to say is...
We'll finish with you.
I want to end up by saying that. Thank you. I'm having a hard time being serious. But we must be very careful that we do something that would put us in non-attainment. We currently
right.
are in attainment,
we want to do that.
And
okay.
we don't want to do that. That's
yeah.
all I
okay,
have to
thank
say.
You.
Thank you very
sure.
much.
Thanks. Go ahead. Nice to have you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Yankee, I'm sorry that I wasn't in the room when you called my name. I'm trying to...
Oh, that's okay. I know.
Committees and
it's hard. It's a busy day.
I believe that DEQ probably covered most of the points mm-hmm. that I was going to make, so I'm just going to quickly say mm-hmm. that last summer, the Portland area exceeded the ozone standard 4 times, and the Medford area exceeded the standard 5 times. So we're really teetering on the brink of compliance with these federal standards. So anything that might put us out of attainment is a very serious issue.
Wait a minute, 5 days out of 365?
We'll have to ask.
Okay, that's great.
Actually, anytime you go past that, we're putting people's health into...
Whatever. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And the second point is that if the legislature wants to do something like this, they should wait until the EPA has made that determination. This is premature to pass mm-hmm. legislation such as this. We can wait until EPA has made the determination that it's not important to test newer cars.
Well, we should put in there based on EPA's next recommendation.
And then, okay. And then lastly... Basically, technological progress is happening, and we do have a national push to reduce the sulfur content of gasoline, and those could very well render the inspection and maintenance program unnecessary. But until that happens, we shouldn't tamper with the strategies that exist now.
Okay.
And that's all
I
want to say.
Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1058, and we'll take seriously into consideration all of your testimony. Okay, now what's our next
one?
Representative Lewis, we're going to reopen a public hearing on your bill.
Why is it?
Senate Bill 1213. And I'll just tell you, in case Mike Marshall O'Dot told us that he just doesn't want to put in statute, but he's moving that way. Okay.
Very good, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Leslie Lewis. I'm the state representative for District 29. And in regards to Senate Bill 1213, One of the things we started out at the beginning of this session with was a desire to do some zero-based budgeting in ODOT's budget. And we did get them to agree to do the maintenance portion of their budget and the administrative portion of their budget. And for those that are interested in zero-based budgeting and would like to attend the committee hearings next week in the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development, which, Sarah, are you on that, Jeff?
Mm-hmm.
So, Sarah, you will be there. You will be hearing presentations on zero-based budgeting. Pardon?
And so is Senator Hughes.
Very good. And I view that as kind of a first step. One of the reasons why I'm very interested in the concept of zero-based budgeting is, and particularly with not only with ODOT's budget, but I believe with other budgets in state government, what we are faced with every session is if we come into the budget process and we are told, this is the current service level. This is all the programs we funded last session, and then you add on all the roll-up costs due to caseload increases and inflation and a whole variety of e-board actions that have happened in the interim. And current service level has kind of become sacrosanct, that you know you can't not do current service level. And I think it is really important in government that we actually do look into departments in more detail than that and actually look at every expenditure they make and determine whether or not that's a program we wish to continue to buy. Now, we didn't go into quite that detail with ODOT with the maintenance and administrative budget. They're going to bring us, they're going to start at zero and build their budget up in increments. And that is typically the way you would do zero-based budgeting. But I believe that this bill could be an important first step. One of the things we were not able to get to in ODOT's budget this session is to look at the whole construction area, which has now been broken up, as into various program areas, bridge, preservation, safety, I mean, the whole long list. But I think that it would be important to start doing this not only with ODOT's budget, but with other budgets in state government. It would be a nightmare from Ways and Means process to do every budget, every biennium, but we ought to make a commitment to do certain budgets each biennium to eventually, over time, get through all of the budgets in state government, because we should be looking at the programs that are funding and not just make the assumption that current service level is where we want to be. We should, as legislators, do the proper oversight and take a closer look than that. And that's why I would urge your passage of Senate Bill 1213.
Yes, Senator Lewis?
Yes.
Are you saying that once an agency goes to a zero-based budgeting, from then on they would stay, or just like every 5 years, every 6 years they should do a zero-based?
Yes, Senator, I don't think you would have to do it every session, but I do think it is important that you do return to this type of format every so often so that a legislature has a chance to really look at every expenditure and to decide whether or not that's how we believe the dollars should be spent. And that's what's not occurring now in the Ways and Means process, because we really don't look into much depth into current service level.
Okay, thanks. Did you have questions?
No.
Okay, then we'll, yes, okay.
Thank you very much.
Well, Senator, yes.
Oh, Senator, yes. Representative Lewis, I agree with you that we shouldn't start from current service level, because there may be a lot of unneeded programs.
Correct.
In the current service budget. But I think we were informed by legislative fiscal. I think it was either during the last interim or the interim before, that it's very expensive to do the zero-based budget, because it is time-consuming to start from zero. So I think their advice was to do one or two budgets at a time on zero-based. So you're saying do this one this time, and next session do another budget on zero-based, and do zero-based every 5 years, 5 or 6 years on the same budget.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I'm not sure exactly what kind of schedule you'd want to work out, but I do agree with legislative fiscal. If you try to do every budget in state government using zero-based budgeting every biennium, it would be a nightmare. But I think it is reasonable to pick, you know, two or three budgets, maybe one budget per subcommittee. We have six subcommittees.
Sure.
So maybe you could pick one budget per subcommittee each biennium and say, you know, for this session we're going to do zero-based budgeting on, you know, the Department of Education in the education sub, and we're going to do ODOT in the transportation sub, and so on.
So it could be a rotating basis.
Yes.
Okay. Senator.
Thank you. It's nice to have you here, Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Senator.
When Mike Marsh was here a little bit ago, he said that he felt like we wouldn't get back the return on the money spent to do this, and that he had some alternative methods of getting to what you want to get to, but it wouldn't be, you know, putting it into statute to do the zero-based budget. And he felt that he could accomplish what you're trying to accomplish without doing that and without having to spend this much, you know, the money that it would take to do that. Have you talked with him about that or explored what those other options might be?
Madam Chair, Senator Castillo, I really haven't had a chance to explore those options with him. I know that on relatively short notice, because we didn't start talking about the zero-based budgeting with the Department of Transportation until the beginning of this session. So on relatively short notice, they were able to do that for us on the maintenance budget and on the administrative portion of their budget, and those are, you know, those are significant portions of their budget.
Yeah.
So I understand their concern, but I think if an agency would, if Senate Bill 1213 were to pass, the agency would certainly have a 2-year warning that we expected to have the zero-based budgeting on other elements of their budget as well. There may be modifications in terms of just terminology. I know even in what we're doing this session, it wouldn't be in some circles considered a true zero-based budget because we did let them go in fairly large percentage jumps. And maybe that's what Mr. Marsh is referring to, but I'd be happy to get with him and discuss it. But I think it's important to make this, to start moving towards this, where we do several budgets of biennium.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on zero base. Senate Bill 1213. Okay, then we're going to turn another quick one. How about Senate Bill, which one? Senate Bill 1265. Is there anyone here to testify on that? Okay, we're open to public hearing on Senate Bill 1265. The man had to come from Medford, so maybe I'll do it next week. You want to tell us what it does?
Senate Bill 1265 requires local access road users to repair and maintain the road.
Okay, we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 1265.
Are you coming back, Senator? We're going to do cover bridges pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. Well, we need four votes. Okay, sorry. Oh, yes, we'll talk to her. Okay, then. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1305. Would you tell us what that says?
Senate Bill 1305 requires foreign vessels to have state licensed pilots on board when traveling within 3 miles of specified pilot grounds, such as in the situation for New Carissa. They didn't have a pilot to get them into Coos Bay if they needed to see bad weather, so this bill is trying to help clarify some of that.
Okay. Is there anyone here to testify on 1305? Okay, then we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1305. Okay. And yeah, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 687. Is there anyone here to testify on that? That's a good bill. Come on up. Tell us what it does.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 687 defines what a school zone is, as well as changes the definition of what it means when children are seven. It makes that more clear.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, thank you for hearing this bill. That's extremely important.
to our community traffic safety advocate.
Would you identify yourself?
Oh, yes. I'm Helen Leary, and I am the director of an organization called Alliance for Community Traffic Safety in Oregon, ACTS Oregon. And just because some of you may not know what ACTS Oregon is, we are a nonprofit that promotes traffic safety statewide. We're trying to reduce the injuries and fatalities that result from vehicle crashes on our highways. And our community programs are very visible in every one of your communities. Right today in Eugene, there's a child safety seat checkup clinic going on. In Albany, at the Traffic Safety Committee, they have a reader board that they use, are very active. And, of course, here in Salem, there's not only Traffic Safety Committee, but we recently had child safety seat checkups at at Temecula Community College. I mention that because all of our efforts come from local community comments and concerns, and that's where the school zone issue came from. And we put together a statewide task force on school zones, and we looked at all of the problems related to that. We had urban and we had rural representatives looking at it, and we came up with a whole host of improvements that we are recommending, many of them really just policy and best practice issues that we're pursuing. But two of them require legislation. One is, and both of those are dealt with in Senate Bill 687. One is the definition of school zone. Do you know where a school zone is when you're driving by a school? A lot of people would assume if I'm driving by a school, I'm in a school zone. That's not true. And that's what this bill clarifies and establishes so that drivers know, kids know, teachers know, and so that we can educate the public. The second thing this bill does is it redefines when children are present. The current legislation is when children are visible or they can reasonably be expected to be visible. Now, is it reasonable to expect a child to be visible at 4 a.m. in the morning? And yet we have had reports of citations being issued at these odd hours. Is it reasonable to expect a child to be visible during school hours when there's no child by the road? And so we've had reports of people slowing down to go 20 miles per hour and very nearly being rear-ended. So what this bill does is it says when children are present means the child is at or in a crosswalk or alongside the road. That is something we can educate people on very clearly so that judges, law enforcement, and drivers all have the same understanding.
I just want to interrupt you because right now if a kid is shooting baskets on the school grounds and you go faster than 20, you can get a ticket.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Yes.
This is a good bill.
Thank you. The statewide task force worked long and hard. There is an amendment that we are going to suggest, and we are providing that to Senator Bryan's office. Something that's not included here that we were asked to include as a fourth condition. If you recall, we said at a crosswalk, in a crosswalk, alongside the roadway. Again, within the school zone, which is defined by this bill. What the fourth condition that we would like to see added is when children are present on an exterior unfenced school ground within 50 feet of the roadway. There are a few school grounds still not fenced. And if children are with, yes, and if right. children are within 50 feet, a driver can easily see 50 feet, and it would be important to protect those children. The second thing is to, the second part of the amendment will make it clear and create the offense of violating the speed limit in a school zone when a motorist goes over 20 miles per hour and yellow school zone lights are flashing or when children are present. Now you might say, isn't that the way it is now?
Yeah.
Actually, the way it is now is if you are within the urban growth boundary in a county with more than 100,000 people, and I'm sure everyone knows whether they are or not, but if you are, then indeed 20 miles per hour is the maximum speed. However, if you are not, exceeding 20 miles per hour when children are present is only prima facie evidence of breaking the basic rule. So what this does is say 20 miles per hour is the maximum speed regardless of where you are in the state when you are in a school zone and children are present or lights are flashing. So that's the amendment that we will be submitting. It will add a fourth condition of when children are present, and it will clarify that it's a maximum speed limit.
Okay,
you're over 20.
Do you live here in Salem?
No, I live up in Clackamas County.
Okay, because I didn't want you to have to come back, but if you, we'll work the bill next week, and if you'll get that amendment. Do you think it's in the Legislative Council?
It is. I just brought the amendment down to Senator Bryan's office, and we have a number of people from other areas of the state that would love to come and talk to you about this bill, too. They didn't have enough.
Well, I don't want them to have to come if we're going to pass it. We'll just pass that bill. I mean, do you support it?
Oh, yeah.
It's a good deal, right? So they don't have to come.
Okay, we'll
just need your amendment through Legislative Council.
Great.
That's where you have to take it.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's all ready today?
Yeah, I'm taking it to Senator Bryan's office. It's in my form with his.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Then you can actually give it to us. Okay, give it to them. Have them give it to us. We can do it by Wednesday. It'll be ready by Wednesday. Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This closes the public hearing on. Was anybody else to say? On Senate Bill 687. Okay. Now. What was 687 here? Sorry, I already did it then. Okay, here we go. Okay, we'll cover bridges. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 608, covered bridges. Is anybody here to testify on 608? Okay. Doug. Okay. It has a prior referral to Ways and Means. Okay. Okay.
Senator Shannon, members of the committee, good afternoon. Awfully great afternoon. Jim Pendle, Oregon Department of Transportation, Maintenance Engineer. Senate Bill 608 does, I think we've had this bill in the past. It directs $150,000 for the restoration and maintenance of covered bridges. I just want to make clear that the expenditures. This is $150,000 from the highway fund, and expenditures from the highway fund can only be used on those bridges that are on public roads. There's about 50 covered bridges in the state. There's about 10 of them that are not on on a public road. They're in a park or something. So I just want to make clear that issue. In the past, there's been money appropriated, I believe, from lottery for those other covered bridges. That's essentially what the bill does. It's we do currently spend money on covered bridges when they're on roads because we got to keep them open anyway.
Thank you. So how much can we do with this money? I mean, do we know how many bridges we can really work on with this allocation? I mean.
Senator Yee, Senator Castillo, we sort of do it on a need basis. We've done probably as good a job as we've done on other bridges in terms of keeping these things in shape. They're all in operating condition, the ones that are on public roads. So I can't tell you exactly which ones we would work on, but I can tell you that we would do it on a as needed basis, the worst first, and working back that direction.
I mean, are we talking about all of this to be used on one bridge, or do you think this will stretch out over several?
Sure, Shannon, Senator Castillo, I don't envision this being used on one bridge. This will be used on for work on multiple bridges rather than large-scale work on one bridge.
Great. Thanks.
If they find the money.
Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, a question for Doug. Doug, don't you regularly maintain your vehicle carrying cover bridges?
Chair Shannon, Senator, yeah, we do. So there is some money being spent even today, even without this bill. There's some money being spent on covered bridges. This bill goes to a little bit farther in terms of the restoration part. I mean, it's eventually you're going to have to spend the money sometime or another anyway, and this bill just makes sure that we're spending some money, but making sure that we're taking care of our covered bridges along with all of our other needs.
Yes, thank you. I understand you regularly maintain and keep up with your vehicle carrying bridges. So how much money do you have for next biennium for this?
Chair Shannon, Senator Yee, without this bill,
The cover bridges fall into the same category as all other bridges, and we would prioritize them. I don't have a specific enough work plan to tell you exactly how much money we would spend on covered bridges without this bill. But without this bill, they would fall into the regular priority structure so that we would maintain them and keep them open. But we would not set aside a specific amount for covered bridges without this bill.
Will you, another question.
Oh, as many as you want.
Thank you. Will you, check into it to see what money have you appropriated for vehicle carrying covered bridges?
Sure, Shannon, Senator Dee, again, we haven't made a specific designation. We don't designate to specific types of bridges. We just do bridge maintenance in general as it is needed as it comes up.
Mm-hmm.
So we have not made a specific appropriation to covered bridges.
See, I hate to see we make a special appropriation if they're going to do it anyway.
It's a good deal. Let's do it.
So I want to see how much are they going to do already.
Well, can you work that out in ways and means?
Well, can you check into it and just see what priorities do these bridges have?
Sure, Shannon, Senator, how about if I suggest this? How about if we go back and find out how much we spent? I don't believe we have this specific appropriation this biennium. How about if we go back and find out how much we spent this biennium?
Yes.
That ought to give you some idea.
That's right.
About kind of what the number would be. And we can do that. We can do that in reporting ways and means if you'd like, Senator.
Yes, okay. Let us know as soon as you have. Madam Chair, I think we need to amend the bill with the sponsor's permission to say vehicle-carrying bridges, not just covered bridges.
What do you think, sponsor?
Well, that was what my question was going to be today. So how many, in the last 10 years, how many bridges, covered bridges, and obviously this includes county bridges,
yes.
Correct? How many of these covered bridges have moved from being vehicle to not being able to be allowed to have vehicles on them?
Senator Shannon, Senator George, I don't know. you know, there's one, I know they're moving one into a park at some point. I don't believe we've decommissioned any. I think they've moved some and replaced them with other bridges. I don't know that we've red tagged any, to put it that way.
I think the reason for the bill is the fact that we've had a progression of deterioration of these bridges. These are a part of the history of Oregon. They're part of the tourism in a lot of areas. They're listed in almost every tourism brochure that we encourage people to come. And we lost one of them down on the coast. We have another one that's about to go away. And it's just really, really sad that we cannot do the restoration part. In fact, maintenance hasn't been maintaining. The word maintain means to, you know, mm-hmm. to level out and keep equal. We haven't been doing that. These bridges are going downhill. And so
do you want to amend it to the words she said?
Yes.
And we'll
vehicle carrying.
Vehicle carrying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Do you,
I was agreeable for that. We talked about earlier.
Okay, you did. Okay.
Yeah.
Should we, just because it's two words, shall we just do it now in a work session, or what do you think?
Unless, Madam Chair, Senator George wants to put lobbying money into
another section.
Yeah, restoring the non-vehicle carrying bridges, mm-hmm. the bridges that have gone down the hill.
Right.
Oh, we could work this next week then, if you guys are going to
do
all that. Okay.
Yeah,
we're going to close the public hearing on.
Madam Chair, I want to ask that. Is that enough to say vehicle carrying covered bridges for Highway Department to?
Sure, Shannon, Senator Yee, I'm not positive that you need that amendment because of the constitutional restrictions on the highway fund. We can only spend the money on bridges that are on public roads. So I think you've already got the constitutional restriction in there.
Oh, I think that makes it clearer because the vehicle carrying bridges will be taken care of by highway money, and the non-vehicle carrying covered bridges can be taken care of by lottery money.
You know what? I think you need two different bills so that we really do. Because one comes out of the transportation budget, one comes out of the general fund.
One bill is enough. We can add a section to say.
Yeah, but what if it doesn't make it? Let's have two vehicles, two bills.
What is it that won't make it? You mean the lottery funds?
Yes.
there's a man in the middle.
Okay.
You still don't want to work it today, then?
Well, I would yield with Senator Yee, and we'll see if we can't come up with that.
Yeah.
See, I don't know that we can mix it like that. Can this much out of transportation dollars, this much out of lottery? That's a relating question.
I know when I did cover bridges before, we only had one bill that will cover both of them.
Yeah,
and one is funded by lottery, and one.
Yeah, you can. It's a relating clause. Yeah, okay.
Same relating clause.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 608, and you guys work it out with her next week.
Okay. And Doug will come back with an answer.
Yeah. Okay. 11:50. Okay, let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1150. Do we have people sign up for this one? Well, let's see. Representative Carol Fuller, will you testify? You only have four people against you. So we won't be moving this bill today, but
only four people.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, there may only be four people signed up, but I assure you there are more than four people against me.
They represent a lot of people.
My name is Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. OAD represents franchise new car dealers. And this bill is kind of a fun bill because it's been a good education for me. It's one of those drop the pebbles in the water thing and watch the ripples. And this thing has got tidal waves. For such a simple bill, it's been a good education. So let me run you through it real quick just to share with you where it came from and why it's not going anywhere. I talked with my legislative committee.
You have two more.
Okay. I talked with my legislative committee and I asked them what problems they were facing last year, and they said that they are spending an awful lot of money taking vehicles out of their used car inventory to DEQ test stations and having them tested before they could sell them. Because the law requires a foreign-plated vehicle, which that is a vehicle that has a license plate that's not an Oregon license plate, or vehicles that are within 4 months.
We'll see if we can't come up with
I don't know that we can mix it like that, and this much out of transportation dollars, this much out of lottery. That's a relating clause.
I know when I did cover bridges before, we only had one bill that will cover both of them.
Yeah,
and one is funded by lottery, and one.
Yeah, you can. It's a relating clause. Yeah, okay.
Same relating clause.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 608. And you guys work it out with her next week.
Okay. And Doug will come back with an answer.
Yeah. 11:50. Okay, let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1150. Do we have people sign up for this one? Well, let's see. Representative Carol Fuller, will you testify? You only have four people against you. So we won't be moving this bill today, but
only four people.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, there may only be four people signed up, but I assure you there are more than four people against me.
They represent a lot of people.
Well, my name is Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. OAD represents franchise new car dealers. And this bill is kind of a fun bill because it's been a good education for me. It's one of those drop the pebbles in the water thing and watch the ripples. And this thing's got tidal waves. For such a simple bill, it's been a good education. So let me run you through it real quick just to share with you where it came from and why it's not going anywhere. I talked with my legislative committee.
You have two more.
Okay. I talked to my legislative committee and asked them what problems they were facing last year, and they said that they are spending an awful lot of money taking vehicles out of their used car inventory to DEQ test stations and having them tested before they could sell them. Because the law requires a foreign-plated vehicle, which that is a vehicle that has a license plate that's not an Oregon license plate, or vehicles that are within 4 months of their registration renewal to be DEQ tested before you can transfer ownership or registration on the vehicle. So those vehicles that aren't in our inventory have to be taken to DEQ to be tested. Most dealers, as a courtesy to our customers, go get a DEQ tested for the customer. We can require our customers to take the car they bought, go to DEQ, get the test done, bring it back to us, and then do the paperwork. So as a courtesy, we do it on behalf of the customer. Now, according to the DEQ letter dated March 3rd, which you have in the packet of information being distributed, of the approximately 625,000 cars that were tested in 1998, about 105,500 of them came from car dealers. Now, think about that for a minute, because what the bill does is allow us to do DEQ testing in our own service facilities that we have in our dealership. We could, by passing this bill, take 100,000 round trips per year off of congested roads in Oregon. And I thought, yeah, that's a good idea. Everybody's talking about congestion being a big problem, and we could take 100,000 cars off the road a year. And I thought, everybody's going to like that. And I looked at it further, and I thought, if the average round trip between a dealership and a DEQ test station was about 10 miles, and I've got a survey that I did to my dealers, and I asked them what the round trip distance is, and we're trying to get all the averages figured out, but just for the sake of example, let's take an average 10-mile round trip on 100,000 cars. We're talking about 1,000,000 miles not traveled on Oregon roads if dealers could do their own testing. And Mr. Green from DEQ was up here talking about the projection of the additional miles that are going to be traveled on Oregon roads as the population increases. And I thought, we could take 1,000,000 miles off the roads in Oregon. That would be good because there'd be less wear and tear, there'd be less congestion, less pollution from those 100,000 vehicles on the round trip. And imagine, because perhaps those of you that are in the DEQ attainment areas, you get complaints from consumers that have to wait in line at DEQ test stations. Sometimes the waits can be lengthy. If we were to take 100,000 vehicles out of those lines on an annual basis, because the dealers were doing the testing themselves, and I thought, but that's good for DEQ, to get 100,000 vehicles out of their lines. And finally, it seems to me that this would save DEQ money, because we'd be paying the same fee to DEQ that we're paying them now to do the testing, except we'd do the testing. So they'd get the same amount of money and 100,000 fewer vehicles to be tested. It seemed to me that this would be a win-win for everybody. And then I got some information from DEQ on the impact. Now, this is a federal program. We do have a federal agreement, and DEQ doesn't want to go out of faith with the federal government, and I understand that. And so we looked at the potential impact that this could have in the Portland and Medford airship quality areas. And in that March 3rd letter that you have in your packet, Mr. Green suggests that if our bill was adopted, the increase in pollution would be approximately 1,500 pounds per day, 1,500 pounds of VOC per day, and that seems like a lot. I thought, man, I can't believe that the dealer's testing their own vehicles. So I think we could catch as many polluting vehicles as DEQ could, or close to it anyway, pretty close to it. That's an extra 1,500 pounds of pollution per day. And then I saw, in order for us to meet attainment in the year 2006, part of this 10-year plan, in Portland, they can pollute, we can emit 360,000 pounds per day, and that keeps us in attainment, 360,000 pounds. So in other words, my 1,500 pounds that this bill would create, we're talking about 0.4% of attainment, is the impact, the potential impact this bill could have on the amount of pollution that's being put in the ozone or being put in the air in the Portland area. I don't have the Medford numbers, but I'm going to assume that it's similar. And I thought a bill that impacts less than 0.5% of the pollution in Oregon in the year 2006, but saves 1,000,000 miles of vehicle travel, puts 100,000 cars off the road for a vehicle trip, it seemed to me a pretty simple trade-off. But boy, was I wrong.
Yep.
Because what the DEQ has indicated, and again, they've got to stay in containment, is that 0.5% would have to be made up, and it would be done on the backs of big industry. Well, that pits me against Associated Oregon Industries and Ralph Groner, and I guess, you know, I should introduce a bill at least once a session that Ralph can kill so he can keep his job, and I guess this is going to be it for this session.
So I guess we're not going to move it, you think?
I don't think we're going to move it.
Okay, all right.
Question for Daryl.
Yes.
Daryl, does it take special equipment to test these
air pollution standards.
It does. The Portland and Medford areas are different. In the Portland, you have the dynamometer, and in the Medford area, you have the standardized test. Dealers have similar, but not the exact equipment in our shops. We have five gas analyzers that do emissions testing. What's interesting is the DEQ certifies dealers to do repairs of vehicles that do not pass the test. They have a program that certifies us to do those repairs. So they know we can do the repairs to get the vehicles in shape to pass the test.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if they can certify us to do the repairs, then obviously they have a certain amount of confidence that we know what a vehicle is going to pass or not going to pass.
Okay. Thanks.
Oh, so...
Go ahead, ask.
So, Madam Chair, so you mean the dealers can do it without special equipment?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we have the equipment, I believe, to do the testing in-house.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, really quickly.
Yes, we have two more bills I want to wear.
Allow dealers to test.
Madam Chair, Senator George, I don't know the answer to that. Mr. Green from DEQ probably could give you the answer to that question. There are a number of states that have test and repair programs, and most of them allow anybody to do testing, independent repair shops, dealers, everybody. The bill that I have would allow only auto dealers to test and allow only tests of their used car inventory, which is a different feature than what the other states have.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, I appreciate you holding the public.
I'm going to close the, I'm sorry for those that have excellent testimony against this. You can submit it if you'd like and we'll keep it. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1150. And I want to, we have a bill, we had one that had to be time certain, but we have one more before that, which is the highway one. Senate Bill 1301. It shouldn't take but a few minutes. Okay. We did a tap on 1301. Would you look at 1301 and see if we want to work it?
I think Sarah, can I add the bypass?
No, I said we were going to.
That was services.
Well, we can have another public hearing.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to open up public hearing on Senate Bill 1301. You don't want to work it? Okay, then we're going to close.
Like requiring folks to build things.
Okay. You were just kidding.
Yeah, oh, yeah, thanks.
Okay, it requires the Department of Transportation to build a highway in Washington County from the Interstate 5 to U.S. Highway 26. There's no one here to testify for it, so we're going to close that again, I think. Oh, it's all those senators from Washington County. So we're going to...
Yeah, let's put a turn on Lane County together and come up with our own project.
We'll have it. Anyway, so we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1301. And now we're going to open an interesting hearing on Senate Bill 1282.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 1282 awards costs and attorney fees to contractors who prevail in disputes regarding compensation on public contracts, and it requires the public contract agency to respond to claims within 21 days.
Okay, and Michael Kelly and Carl Thatcher, would you please come forward and share with us your experience and why you want this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Kelly. I'm a contract administrator for a company called KC Contracting Incorporated. KC Contracting does traffic control and other activities on public improvement projects for the Department of Transportation. We operate primarily as a subcontractor to prime contractors who do major road improvements and construction in the state of Oregon. We're here today, or I'm here today, to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1282. KC Contracting has existed for about 7 years, and during that period of time, we have noted a very marked and distinct deterioration in the Department of Transportation's ability to effectively and fairly administrate contracts, primarily in the area of payments of contractors and subcontractors. And We've also found ourselves with a marked and distinct increase in the amount of time that we've had to spend in pursuing payments for work that's been performed. To keep our comments brief because of the time element...
You have till 5 o'clock.
Thank you. I would just like to share with you one example that has been very, should we say, traumatic to our company in general. And I should say that I recognize that this bill will deal with all public contracts, but I can only speak to our experience dealing primarily with the Department of Transportation as a contractor. The project that I'm referring to was the replacement of the trunnion on the Columbia River Bridge over the Columbia River, the I-5 bridge, in the fall of 1997. That project for us, we had originally been awarded a subcontract in the amount of about $250,000 to provide traffic control on that project. It immediately became apparent to the Department of Transportation that their planned traffic control was extremely inadequate, and that they were interested in expanding that project and our function on that project to include significant additional work. To put it in monetary terms, our contract essentially ballooned from about $250,000 to about $1,250,000, so about 500 times the original contract was the amount of work contemplated to be done. At the conclusion of our primary work on the contract, on that project, which was done in November of 1997, we had been paid approximately the original contract amount, about $250,000, although we had performed pretty much all of the work that we were obligated to do. There's a lot of extenuating circumstances that go into that, but essentially, if you can picture we received payments that totaled about $750,000 through the end of October, and then sometime in November, the Department of Transportation realized that they hadn't processed their paperwork correctly and decided that they were going to remove about $400,000 of the money they'd already paid to the prime contractor. A good portion of that was money that was destined for us, and so we found ourselves in a position where we suddenly owed our prime contractor several hundred thousand dollars. And that also correlated with other events, activities where we were trying to pursue payment. We had already felt, even after we received $750,000, we felt we had been underpaid about $600,000. And so we were not only actively trying to pursue payment for that money and to get where we felt we needed to be, but then at some point they actually took an additional $700,000 they'd already paid away from us, ostensibly because they had felt that they hadn't done their paperwork properly. Naturally, that caused a great deal of stir amongst the contractors involved, and eventually they wound up paying that money not too far in the future, about a month and a half later. But by the end of 1997, the Department of Transportation had stated for the record through letters that they felt that all issues regarding that project were resolved, and that the $750,000 that they had paid us was adequate for the work that we had done. For the last year and a half, we've spent an inordinate amount of time trying to pursue the payment for the remainder of those funds. And since the time that ODOT said that they felt all issues were resolved and that they essentially did not owe us any money, they have paid us approximately an additional $500,000. But in pursuit of that money, we have spent, through administrative costs, through attorneys, through a variety of activities, approximately $100,000 attempting to obtain that money. And the position of the Department of Transportation is that those costs are not compensable. Now, we feel that they are due through an ambiguity in the specifications that ODOT has that are incorporated in all their contracts. But their official position is that those aren't compensable to us and that we can't recover those funds. And so the reason we feel this legislation is necessary for a variety of reasons. One, that's not a unique experience. We find that we are spending more and more time trying to pursue payments for work that we've done, and ODOT has become less and less responsive to those requests. They don't respond to letters. Essentially, their attitude is, well, we don't feel we owe it to you, so that's all there is to it. And so we try to pursue our claims to a higher and higher level, and because of the amount of time that it takes for them to respond to our attempts, that these things drag out, and the the claim on the attorney's project that I spoke about is still going on. And we're still in that process. But we've recovered, like I said, approximately $500,000 more additional dollars beyond the point of when they said they didn't thought they owed us anything. And we believe there's still additional funds that will be compensated. But we're here almost a year and a half later after that, the end of that project, still trying to pursue our money, still accruing costs. And in a way, you could say that our time here today is a cost associated with that, because we probably wouldn't be here but for that experience. So what we'd like to do is, what we feel is this legislation will accomplish a couple of things. One, it will make, it will give ODOT an incentive to try to resolve issues like this in a timely fashion, actually by legislating it, but also by putting a monetary incentive for the department to work as expeditiously as possible with their contractors to resolve issues that they don't become expensive, because ultimately the Department of Transportation may be the one to bear those costs of those expenses if the contractor prevails.
Mike, just a second. Have you ever sued them for money they owed you and you lost?
Our company has never actually had to have a trial, so to speak. We have had filed legal action, and usually those things are resolved.
When you file the best attorney.
Exactly. But we have never pursued a claim in which we have not recovered some funds.
Okay.
So we have no incentive to pursue claims that we do not feel justified in pursuing, because they're very time intensive and do require a great deal of overhead. So just like any business, we don't pursue litigation with the state unless we feel that it's justified. And just as if our subcontractors were to pursue litigation with us, we would have no incentive to stretch it out or protract it, because it could ultimately be, it's costly to us, and it can ultimately be additionally costly if we were to found to be, you know, if we were to lose that litigation. So we feel that currently, since ODOT is not technically, you know, it's not a business, it's not, has no financial incentive to settle, and it seems evident in their behavior that they make no effort or not fulfilling what we feel would be a responsibility to assist the private companies that they contract with in resolving problems. I mean, what we encounter is exactly the opposite, basically antagonism and lack of cooperation when it comes to payment.
Oh, Carl, did you want to add to that?
Sure. Mike's a lot more elegant than I am, but I'm Carl Thatcher, Madam Chair and distinguished senators. I work for KT Contracting. This bill is important because it fulfills the intent of the existing law by giving it more teeth. The law says it is the policy of the state that all payments be made promptly. I believe that we can all agree that a contractor's resources are limited, and whereas the state seems to be unlimited sometimes. So, like Mike was saying, you often get the attitude that, well, we can't make a decision at our level, and it's sent to a higher level with no time frame in sight. We would just like to see all of the contractors' costs compensable, and in pursuing legitimate claims where a contractor prevails.
Because that's what the Efficiency Committee came up with, too, is that the decisions can be made by people that, you know, that you usually deal with. Was it people in the financial office that told you they couldn't make the decision? Who said they couldn't make the decision?
The people that we usually deal with are the project managers, the inspectors on the project. Decisions from them are rare lately, and this has occurred over the last couple of years, where we've noticed mm-hmm. the distinct lack of authority that they may have to resolve things at a lower level. Perhaps they need more authority, but we feel we're constantly put off to another level. And then, of course, you go in dealing with presenting your case again to a brand new set of ears who've already been... I guess because they're part of the Department of Transportation, they've already heard one side, and then our hearing is maybe a half hour to 15 minutes.
You present your case very briefly?
Oh, yeah, compared to mm-hmm. what the other side has had to poison the well, I guess, if you use
well, we have some concerns, but the broadness of your bill.
Okay.
And on page 2, line 32, it says 9, notwithstanding subsection of this, And what they're concerned about is that every other public agency, all the schools, all the counties, everybody, when you're really having your problem with the Department of Transportation. And so what they would like to do is delete on line 32 everything, the whole, I think it's the first, until the first comma. And so it would be a capital W. And then at the, you know, do you have the bill?
Yes.
Okay, do you want to mark?
I'm not sure we have the same version that you have.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do.
1282.
Yeah, 1282. It's on page 2, line 32. And you delete everything notwithstanding subsection 8 of this section. That's just gone, and you make it start with a capital W. And then it would say in the next line, 33, at the end, you would delete a public contracting agency and put in Oregon Department of Transportation. Frankly, people from other dealing with other agencies haven't complained to us as much as contractors have. And on line 36, everything would be deleted until you got to the word cost, and it would start with a capital C. And then on line 40, the first four words are deleted, and you would replace it with Oregon Department of Transportation. On line 42, you delete the last two, well, actually delete public contracting agency and put Oregon Department of Transportation. And on line 45, a public contracting agency is deleted, and you replace it with ODOT. And on line 2, on the next page, those four words, the public contracting agency is deleted, and it was any failure by ODOT. So those conceptual amendments have been offered to me by many other people representing other government, what do you call them, government, public contracting agency. So would you be opposed if we made those amendments to your bill?
Madam Chair, for the record, Mike Kelly responding to your question. No, I don't believe that we would have an objection. Again, our experience is primarily with the Department of Transportation, and obviously in self-interest, that's the problem that we feel needs to be addressed, so we would not object to those changes. However, I believe we would like to may perhaps offer one additional suggested change, and that is, as you alluded to earlier, one of the primary problems that we're encountering is the willingness and ability of those people at the lower levels of the Department of Transportation to address and resolve these issues. And in section one of the section one sub 10, in which it states that the cost of a reasonable attorney's fee shall be available to the prevailing contractor only if the resolution of the dispute occurs beyond the region manager review level of the claims process. We might suggest that be changed to the project manager review level.
Okay.
The reason for that change is that the project manager is probably the last person who is the most familiar with the project. Once you get beyond that to the region level, that person is probably only peripherally familiar with the project. The project manager himself is the one who is intimately familiar with the details, we believe. And so that should be the last person who should have a chance to resolve this before we are entitled to a contractor would be entitled.
So you don't want to keep going through the ropes. You want
We'd like the law to give the Department of Transportation the most incentive to resolve it at the lowest level. The other reason is because we've also noticed that beyond that, it becomes more time intensive and more expensive once it reaches a region review level, because there's a greater learning curve there and a greater period of time that it takes.
More people involved.
More people and more time.
Okay. So you're on line 38, you want project manager. Just project.
Yeah, project manager review level. That's correct.
Okay. Well, we'll bring this up next week, Sam. Do you have any questions, Senator George?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, this is not the first time we've heard this. In fact, we had cities that are complaining about not having their contracts kept, and it goes on, and we could talk about access management where agreements were reached and they weren't completed. But I want to ask, this issue relative to contractors keeps coming back, and I keep thinking about somewhere down the line this costs us a lot of money. And I'll tell you why. There's five contractors doing this job, and I burned this one, then I burned this one, and then I burned this one, then I burned this one, then I burned that one. When I go back for a bid, what do these people do? They pad that bid. They've got to, because they know that they may get caught in this scenario where they don't get compensated for the extra work that's been required of them. And I think this is so necessary to clarify this process.
I want to tell you that more than one contractor has told me that, because it is so
I
hard
tell
to
you
collect.
I stories that just make your blood boil.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if there is nothing, do you have a question, Senator Castillo?
Or are we going to give ODOT a chance to respond to some of the things?
Well, let's see. Did they sign up? They did not.
Okay.
But I absolutely would before I ever worked at
okay.
Senator Castillo.
Sure.
Right. Do you have a comment, Senator Doug? To my husband, I call him bureaucrat.
Yeah,
I'm only teasing.
Chair Shannon, member of the committee, just briefly to the bill. Our concern with the bill would be that by awarding attorney's fees, if you had a $100,000 claim, for instance, by awarding attorney's fees to the prevailing party, if eventually $99,900 of that was found to be frivolous, but $1 was found to be legitimate, the Department of Transportation would have to pay $1 plus all the attorney's fees. So it becomes an incentive maybe for the department to settle, but also an incentive for the contractors possibly to pursue every possible dollar, because if they can get one, then their attorney's fees didn't cost them anything. And that would be my concern about the breadth of the bill.
That's your only concern. That's easy. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1282. And if there's no further business to come before us, we will. But I have an announcement. Next week, I would like to hold a Friday meeting Tuesday evening. And so we would go Monday, Tuesday night, Wednesday, and that's it for the week. Is that all right?
What time?
When to when?
When to when? 6 to 8.
I'm not sure. We have Monday night work session.
Mm-hmm.
We have a public affairs evening meeting somewhere in there, and I believe I have a seminar evening meeting somewhere in there as well.
Can we pull you in if we need votes?
Maybe out of public affairs, probably not out of SAM, and we're doing the measure 66. So
okay.
We only have a couple of weeks.
Would it be Tuesday night?
I've always wanted.
Question, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, this is not the first time we've heard this. In fact, we had cities that are complaining about not having their contracts kept, and it goes on, and we could talk about access management where agreements were reached and they weren't completed. But I want to ask, this issue relative to contractors keeps coming back, and I keep thinking about somewhere down the line this costs us a lot of money. And I'll tell you why. There's five contractors doing this job, and I burned this one, then I burned this one, and then I burned this one, then I burned this one, then I burned that one. When I go back for a bid, what do these people do? They pad that bid. They've got to, because they know that they may get caught in this scenario where they don't get compensated for the extra work that's been required of them. And I think this is so necessary to clarify this process.
I want to tell you that more than one contractor has told me that, because it is so hard to collect.
Or is it just makes your blood boil?
Yeah. Okay. Well, if there is nothing, do you have questions, Senator Castillo?
Are we going to give ODOT a chance to respond to some of the things?
Well, let's see. Did they sign up? They did not.
Okay.
But I absolutely would before I ever worked at Senator Castillo.
Okay.
Right. Do you have a comment? Senator Dodge?
Senator Dodge.
To my husband, I call him bureaucrat. I'm only teasing.
Chair Shannon, members of the committee, just briefly to the bill. Our concern with the bill would be that by awarding attorney's fees, if you had a $100,000 claim, for instance, by awarding attorney's fees to the prevailing party, if eventually $99,900 of that was found to be frivolous, but $1 was found to be legitimate, you would the Department of Transportation would have to pay $1 plus all the attorney's fees. So it becomes an incentive maybe for the department to settle, but also an incentive for the contractors possibly to pursue every possible dollar, because if they can get one, then their attorney's fees didn't cost them anything. And that would be my concern about the breadth of the bill.
That's your only concern. That's easy. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1282. And if there's no further business to come before us, we will. But, I have an announcement. Next week, I would like to hold a Friday meeting Tuesday evening. And so we would go Monday, Tuesday night, Wednesday, and that's it for the week. Is that all right?
When to when?
When to when? Six to eight.
Make sure we have Monday night floor session.
Mm-hmm.
We have a public affairs evening meeting somewhere in there, and I believe I have a sermon evening meeting somewhere in there as well.
Can we pull you in if we need votes?
Maybe out of public affairs, probably not out of SAM when we're doing the major 66 stuff.
Okay.
Would
it be Tuesday night?
I've always wondered why we don't do Thursday afternoon. Senator George's committee does Monday, Wednesday and Thursday, so we don't end up in a Friday afternoon situation.
Okay, well, let's talk about Thursday afternoon. Thursday afternoon, and this room, we're in here with Senator Duncan, but he's about finished. But I do have Senator Duncan. Me, myself. I have the only conflict.
Okay. Then that's not a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody else want to try?
Works for me in person.
It works for you.
Thursday night, you mean, instead of...
Well, Thursday afternoon.
Thursday afternoon.
You know what, I should probably be excused from Senator Duncan's because they probably wouldn't need me in there this Thursday.
In general,
are you open Thursday afternoon?
What time would you meet on Thursday afternoon?
3?
Because I have a meeting that goes from about 4 to 4:30 on Thursdays, every Thursday, so half an hour.
Give an hour.
4 to 4:30?
Mm-hmm. So I could just be out, I'd step out for a half hour, but I could come back.
Okay.
So start at 3, she'd get an hour before she had to leave.
Okay. Then we just, who's missing here?
I don't know. Shannon.
Oh, we've just lost Senator Yee.
Yeah, I'll be gone Thursday and Friday.
Oh. Okay, well...
Well, you won't have me on Friday either. But young morning.
Well, I'm taking the red eye to Virginia Thursday night. So they won't have me on Friday either. Mm-hmm. I was excused a long time ago for my niece's wedding. So, So, let's see.
Tuesday night is okay with me.
We'll just go find you. Okay, thanks. Okay, then next Tuesday, and then at 6, what was it, 6 to 8?
Yeah.
6 to 8, and then what?
Hearing room B,
Tuesday evening, 6 to 8.
Okay.
And then Wednesday afternoon, and then we'll be finished for the week.
Okay,
no further business to come before the committee. We will be adjourned. Thanks for staying, everybody.
You promised it.
hate them.
I promise. Look at...